The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So many of you know that the solar eclipse is happening in a few weeks. For me, I feel a little bit excited about this. And I was imagining what it must be like, you know, at the time of the Buddha. Right? They couldn't predict these things. They didn't have an explanation for them. Whereas for us, for me, I just Googled it, right? And there's a map, and there's the time, and exactly, you know, how it's going to work and everything. But I can imagine that there was a certain amount of maybe mystery or awe or appreciation for some of these events. So in fact, there's a sutta where the Buddha says, there are four splendors. What four? The moon is a splendor. The sun is a splendor. Fire is a splendor. And wisdom is a splendor. That's quite something, right? For wisdom to be up there in the same category as fire and sun and the moon. Maybe one thing, this is my interpretation, I don't know if this is what was intended, maybe one thing is all these things, sun, moon, fire, and wisdom, help us see clearly. They like shine some light, help us see things and maybe understand things differently. So if wisdom is a splendor, what is wisdom? Right? We all have some wisdom. Of course we do. But in the Buddhist teachings, part of wisdom, it's a big, big, giant topic, right? All of us know that. Part of wisdom is the teaching on right view. Also known as wise view. So it's not right as in a contradistinction to wrong. It's right as in appropriate. Just like a hammer is the right tool for a nail and tweezers are not. So it's right in that way, not like a dogmatic right. So if wisdom has part of it is right view, well, what is right view? Wise view. That also is a big topic, but I'd like to talk about two aspects of it tonight. And one is a view, we can understand it as a perspective, as a frame of reference, a way in which we see things. And wise view, right view, encourages us that when we see things, when we're looking at them, to notice that there's cause and effect. Right? This is common sense. We all know this. But part of the Buddhist teaching is to very thoroughly, thoroughly apply this common sense knowledge of cause and effect. Things aren't random. They may feel random sometimes. Things unfold. They arise when the conditions are in place for them to arise. Everything we're experiencing is a consequence of something preceding it. Everything we do now, our thoughts, what we say, our actions, will have consequences. Some of them will be big, obvious consequences. Some of them will be subtle and maybe inconsequential. But there will be some consequences. So wise view is to use this perspective, use this frame of reference with our experiences, to notice that things are unfolding following this principle of cause and effect. As far as I know, there isn't magic. It's not random. But that also doesn't mean that we know what the exact causes are. We don't actually know what the exact conditions are that allowed something to happen. But often we can imagine or even see what are some of the factors that contribute to what happened or what we're experiencing. And as if we look at our experience, and if we look at what's happening, and we pay attention to some of the consequences to our actions, whether they're the way that we think or the things that we say or actual things that we do, we will notice, if you haven't already, some things bring greater happiness and ease and contentment, and some things bring less ease and contentment, right? In the Buddhist word, we use this word suffering to mean discontent, tension, anxiety, worry, these types of things, stress, which the Buddhist word dukkha is kind of like all those words together. I use the word suffering because that's how I learned it, but sometimes suffering feels like too strong of a word. So if you hear me saying the word suffering, you can just also think it's just stress or tension. Anything that's like the opposite of feeling really content and at ease. So if we use this perspective of wise view, we're looking at how things unfold. There's causes and conditions and there's consequences. We will notice that some things cause more ease and some things cause less ease. And in the Buddhist teachings, there is he laid out a list of 10 actions that are, in his experience, and I'll say so far in my experience, lead to less ease, less contentment, suffering. And you may know this list of 10 things. Sometimes they're called the 10 unskillful actions. Because skillfulness in this context is right, things that allow, you know, bring ease. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about these. I'll mention them. For those of you are familiar with them, you'll recognize them. If not, I'll just maybe plant a seed, and the next time you hear them, you'll like, oh yeah, that was that thing. So in these 10 unskillful actions, there's 3 that we do with our mind. I'm sorry, I'm going to start with 3 that we do with the body. Refrain from killing living beings. Refraining from taking that which is not given. And refraining from sexual misconduct. And in this context, sexual misconduct means having sex with somebody who has a commitment to somebody else or who is under protection of somebody else. So these are 3 actions that don't lead to happiness. The 4 actions, the verbal actions, things that we could say: false speech, telling a lie, malicious speech, harsh speech, and gossip. These are the 4 things. I had to practice saying all these false, malicious, harsh, gossip, right? That's kind of all those S's, right? It's kind of... So 4 types of speech, and then 3 things that we can do with our mind. And the first is covetousness, you know, wanting what others have or just feeling, just wanting. And the second is ill will. And the third one is wrong view. So it's actually wrong view to have wrong view. Kind of some of these interesting things, right, of how some of these teachings are. So in this way, we're looking at something that we already know, right? Things have consequences. And then if we look at it, we'll see that certain behaviors lead to greater ease than other behaviors. And then a second part of right view is to apply this understanding, to apply this principle directly to suffering, directly to what's our discomfort, our discontent. This requires that we have a willingness to look at suffering in an honest, mature, direct way, without being an ostrich, without falling into despair, as best we can, right? There are times in our lives when we have a greater capacity and capability to look at suffering, to look at our own suffering, what's happening. And there's other times when we're tired or distressed about something else that we don't really have the capacity, but to the best of our ability to look at our suffering. And then we will see the second part of the right view. There is suffering. There's a cause of suffering. There is the cessation of suffering. There can be the end of suffering. And then the Buddha taught there's a way leading to the end of that suffering. I think you all recognize that as the Four Noble Truths, right? As this second part of the right view. So we can use this perspective and noticing how things unfold in a lawful way. And we can apply that towards suffering. And we can also see then that maybe we could understand right view. Also this expression that I like, that I heard from Gil initially in a Dharma talk. And the expression is this: no mud, no Buddha. That is, right, the mud, the things that we get stuck in, the things that stick to us and we can't let go of, that follows us around. Or maybe the mud as we go away or out of our way to avoid it. Or, right, there's all kinds of things we could understand. What is mud? But then no Buddha, right? No awakening. We need to know and understand, where are we stuck? What is our suffering? In order to understand how we can be free, in order to understand how we can find the ease, we need to see and acknowledge and experience, where is there unease? And not only that, with this perspective of no mud, no Buddha, we can acknowledge that suffering, stress, tension, anxiety is, of course, it's part of our life, but it's also a part of our spiritual practice. It's an integral part. It's not a mistake that's happening on the side and that we'll get to our spiritual practice as soon as that suffering thing ends. It's not, we're not a failure as a human being. We're not a failure as a meditator. We're not a failure as a practitioner because we're experiencing suffering in all its forms. It's an integral part of our practice. How else will we know where we're clinging to things, when we're attached to things? How else will we know where we are not practicing right view, and instead of recognizing that things unfold in a natural way, maybe we have this feeling of like, oh, I want it to be different. You know, I'm going like this with my hands. It kind of has that feeling, right? Sometimes you get all tense and constricted. And it's through noticing, like, oh, wow, I am really tense. My body and my stomach is upset. What's going on? And we can notice, oh, yes. Okay, I don't know exactly what's going on, but maybe I have this view. I want to be seen as somebody in a particular way. A nice person, a knowledgeable person, an upright citizen, I don't know, right? We have all these ideas about how we like to be seen. And we may notice, oh yeah, this person doesn't seem to see me that way. right? And then there's like, then there, oh, but they don't understand, and I don't know what happens, right? All kind of like constriction and stuff. But we may not have noticed that about ourselves, where we are hold on to this idea how we want to be seen in a particular way, unless we had experienced that constriction when somebody doesn't see us in that way. And I'm not saying that it's wrong that we want to be seen a particular way. The difficulty is when we're holding on to that really tightly, when we're clinging to that, when we're attached to this particular idea. Right? I think those of you who have been coming here may know this, right? That clinging and attachment, this is what causes suffering. So we have to notice the suffering in order to see the clinging and the attachment. And sometimes just the seeing itself can help loosen it, can help soften the attachment. Not all the time, right? I think this would be all our experience. And I wish I could tell you, oh yeah, just look at your suffering and everything will be fine. It doesn't quite work that way. But what does happen is that maybe we gain a little insight, just a little. Maybe we gain a little bit of confidence. Like, oh yeah, okay. I looked at that aspect of myself squarely in the eye and it was unpleasant, but it was okay. Or I looked at that suffering squarely in the eye and it was okay. And just these little actions of gaining more confidence by looking at our suffering, or gaining more self-understanding by looking at our suffering. This can have a giant effect. This can have a giant effect. So the next time when we come up a big mud hole, maybe we don't have to walk all the way around. Maybe we can just walk through the mud on the way and see what's on the other side. Yes, this is suffering. Yes, this doesn't match my preferences. But that's okay. And maybe I'll learn something about myself or gain some confidence or gain some skills if I do this. So right view includes this idea of that things are unfolding. And we can use that idea, that perspective, that things are unfolding, and apply them to suffering. And instead of thinking that it's a problem, say, yes, it's part of an unfolding, and examine for ourselves. Like, how did we get here? It may not be obvious, but we may have some ideas about it. So you may say, okay, it seems like it makes sense, seems like a good enough idea, but how do I do this? How do we keep this in mind? How do we keep right view in mind? So there's a small little sutta where the Buddha addresses this. And right now the exact language slips my mind. But he says there are two supports for right view. Number one, careful attention. Right? This makes sense. Our mindfulness practice, when we're doing on the cushion, we see things, subtle suffering, maybe subtle attachments. And even if we're doing mindfulness in our daily life, if we're just paying attention, we just start to see, right, that things have consequences, cause and effect, and there's an unfolding. So that's the first thing that can support kind of this arising of a right view. The second is the utterance of another. That is being reminded. That is, I'm interpreting that as going to Dharma talks, reading books, talking to other people, right? We're part of a community, right? So all of us in some ways. So can we use these communities to remind us our interactions with other people about right view, about recognizing that there's cause and effect. There's conditions that lead to consequences. Instead of getting stuck in that moment that this is how it is or it shouldn't be this way, let's kind of see if we can soften and loosen a little bit. So if that's what supports a right view, careful attention and talking to others, there's also in another sutta where the Buddha is talking to some of his followers, some of his monks, and keeping in mind, right, that this was a completely voluntary to become a monk, right? It was nobody's conscripted to do this. At that time, or nor in contemporary times, as far as I know. And if you ordain, there are a lot of rules, a lot of rules. I think the men have 227 and the women have 300 and... Does anybody know? Yeah, the women have significantly more. Yeah, we'll talk about that another time. Mahapajapati. Yes. But some of these rules that the monks had to follow were about how to treat each other and how to be in community. That makes sense, right? If you're building a religious community, there's some rules on how to behave. So in this sutta, the Buddha is talking to his monks, and I love these words. He says, if a monk is belligerent, irreverent, and uncongenial to his fellow monks, then he will not follow the proper conduct for a monk. That is, he won't be following the rules of a monk, because they have rules about seniority and how that kind of works. That's part of the rules. So if you're belligerent, uncongenial, and irreverent, that sets you off on the wrong path. So if you don't have the right conduct, if you're a monk, then he says you won't satisfy or you won't fulfill the requirements for a trainee. That's also kind of in the monastic order. If you're a trainee, there's certain things that you should be doing. So if you're not following these types of rules, you're not going to follow these other rules. And then if you don't fulfill the requirements of a trainee, you won't have virtuous conduct. You won't have sila. You won't have those 10 skillful actions I talked about earlier. And then if you don't have those 10 skillful actions, you won't have wise view. He's saying it's impossible for wise view. I was thinking about this, like, what is this? I think that if you don't know that you're being belligerent, uncongenial, and irreverent in a situation in which you should be reverent, that means you're not paying attention. It means you're not noticing the suffering of others as well as your own suffering. And if you're not paying attention, then you're not going to notice your own suffering and how it's unfolding and the causes of it. And if you're not noticing that, you're not going to have wise view. So this is part of how the Buddha was discussing, like how you can support wise view with careful attention, talking to others. And then if you notice you find yourself being belligerent, you may ask yourself, what are you not noticing that somehow allows that to unfold in that way? So then, of course, right view is just one part of wisdom. And wisdom is just one part of the Buddhist path to awakening, towards freedom, towards the end of suffering. So what else can assist wise view? What are some of the other elements that can lead to the end of suffering? Not just so that we can notice our suffering and what's causing it or underlying it, but what else can work with wise view to help us with that? It won't be a surprise to many of you if I say wise view is the first factor in the Eightfold Path. So there's seven more factors. They all work together. I'll just say them briefly. I won't discuss them. Each one could be, you know, its own Dharma talk. For those of you who are familiar with them, you'll hear them and like, oh yeah, that's right. If you haven't heard them before, I'm just planting a seed of these eight factors that work together. to find the end of suffering. And they're given in a particular order, but that doesn't mean that we experience them in that order or we work with them in that order. Right view is the first factor. Right intention is the second one. Right speech is the third one. Right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. These eight factors, right, all help with wise view and help us to find freedom and the end of suffering. Not just to notice it, but to find the end of it. But yet I found one more sutta. I was poking around in there in the suttas. What are some other factors that support wise view? There's this list of five, right? All these lists, right? I've given you all these lists. There's no need to remember them all. If you come here often enough, you'll hear them and you'll get them. This is a new one. I hadn't heard this list before. That's what made me excited. Like, oh, a new list. Yes, that says something about me, right? So what are these five elements, these five factors that can support a wise view? And in my opinion, these can support all of the factors in the Eightfold Path. The first one is virtuous behavior, sila. If you know that word sila, it's a Pali word that means virtuous behavior. This makes sense. Like if we are robbing and stealing and pillaging, then we're not going to have the calmness to actually see what's happening, right? So this is kind of common sense. The second one is listening. The word in Pali is the same word for hearing, which is a way in the Buddhist time, that's how the Dharma was heard, right? They didn't have books and they didn't have universities or, you know, didn't have Dharma centers necessarily either, right? So listening is a way of hearing the Dharma, being reminded of the Dharma. The third one is discussion. So I was talking about how what can help wise view arise is the utterance of another, hearing another, but this fleshes it out a little bit and says discussion, talk about it. Whether it's with somebody here in the Sangha or somebody that's maybe not a practitioner, but talk about what perspectives, what frame of reference, what point of views are helpful for your life to unfold in a way that brings greater ease. You can also talk about, well, what are some of your perspectives or your beliefs or worldviews? That the world is a happy place, that the world is a fearful place, or, you know, all of us have some worldviews. It can be really helpful to discuss with others them so that we can, maybe by hearing something that's different than our own, it helps highlight our own views. So the factors that help support wise view are sila, virtuous behavior, hearing the Dharma, discussion. The fourth is calm, meditation, right? Sometimes we don't know our underlying views until we quiet down and they become apparent to us. If we're busy, 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 we don't notice that we think that we should be busy in order to be a good person or whatever it might be, right? It's not until we can calm down that often that some of these views that we have become apparent. And then the fifth thing that we can do to support wise view, to find the end of freedom, is insight. And the word is vipassana, right? This practice, mindfulness, paying attention to what we're doing and what we're experiencing, noticing what we're experiencing, and noticing our relationship to what's experiencing, what we're experiencing. So in this way, maybe like the sun, and the moon, and fire, we can have some of the splendor of wisdom by cultivating some right view, wise view, and understanding that as keeping in mind that there's a principle of cause and effect. We know this, but just to apply this thoroughly, thoroughly to everything that happens. And again, it doesn't mean we'll know exactly what caused this, and nor do we need to know exactly. But we can often know, like, what are the conditions? What are some of the general things that contributed to this arising? And so we can also think about that and what we're doing now. Like, what are going to be the consequences? For example, I've noticed that if I'm on the internet and then I'm clicking, and then like, oh, and I click this, and then I click that, and then, right? Probably many of you have this experience. You just go down the rabbit hole, and then, but then I notice that I made up this word. I get wanty, like this, I want things, right? I just start like kind of like getting, I just want things. This click, 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 I want to know, I want to understand, I want to buy, I want to look at, I want to read. It just kind of has this feeling for me. I want to go to the refrigerator. That's a common one. So I just noticed, like, oh, yeah, here's a consequence of just clicking here and then clicking there. I just know that this is going to arise, that it happens. And sometimes when I have this wanty feeling, I think, like, what was I just doing that made me have this feeling? Like, I just have a lot of desire. I just want stuff. It's quite something. Maybe some of you have experienced this too. So in this way, just like, you know, applying this, well, how did I get here? Not knowing, like I keep on saying this, but I don't want to turn this into an archaeological dig that we do into our psyche. It means that thing that happened when I was 8 years old and blah, blah, blah. Right? That may be contributing, but we don't have to know precisely. We just need to recognize that what we're experiencing now is a consequence of something. We probably have some idea of what it was, and that what we're doing now is going to lead to some other consequences. And then the invitation, the teaching, is to apply this towards suffering. Where is it that we don't feel happy? Where is it that we feel tense and anxious? Can we see how it's part of an unfolding? And can we hold this perspective of an unfolding as opposed to something that I have to fix right now and make this very particular thing happen? That may be wise, too, to go in and interfere and do things. But it can be enormously helpful to see things with a big perspective and then to notice, okay, what can I change? What can I affect? What clinging, what attachment can I soften or let go of? So maybe I'll end there with a heartfelt wish that you find a way to have less suffering, less tension, less discontent. And also a heartfelt appreciation that here we are in this different configuration and without amplification, but we all stuck it out. Thank you very much. Thank you.